Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Jay Hughes, aka Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with Dr. Nancy Shepper Hughes. She's a professor and director of the doctoral program in critical studies of medicine, science, and the body at Berkeley, UCal Berkeley. She's a writer who's dealt mostly with the violence and madness of everyday life from an existentialist, feminist, and a politically engaged perspective, including topics such as the madness of hunger, the acceptable death of angel babies in Brazil, AIDS in Cuba, and the violence and terror in South Africa. Welcome, Dr. Shepper Hughes.
Well, it's good to be here, Jim.
But the reason I'm asking you here today is that we want to talk about Organs Watch, which is a new George Soros-funded project that you've been involved in, and following up on research that you've been doing on the organ market in the third world, principally.
Right.
How did you get interested in this topic?
Well, it began about 1983 or 84, when I was in the midst of doing research in a large shantytown in northeast Brazil on infant mortality and also on some of the problems of the disappearance and death of street children. And I encountered an incredible rumor and was spread wildly throughout the whole northeast region of Brazil, even in the urban areas like Recife, and it said that guard your children, lock them up, because medical agents from Japan and the United States are driving around poor communities in a yellow or sometimes it was a blue combi van. And when they see, you know, poor children on the street, they grab them, they take their organs, and they drop the eviscerated bodies off, and you can find them in hospital dumpsters or you can find them on back roads and in country fields. And I was intrigued by the rumor and started to write some essays about why poor people would, who are reasonably, you know, smart and well-informed and themselves involved in a lot of political actions through liberation theology, and why would they believe such an absurd rumor? And the more I began to follow the bodies and began to go with women to hospital morgues and to mortuaries and to police stations and elsewhere, I found that, of course, people had reasons to fear what happens to the bodies of their loved ones. And it's a very, very old story. And although at that point I wasn't even considering that organs were being, you know, stolen from children and the children were being killed, it was true enough that if a poor person died or if they were very, very ill, their bodies were treated very, very differently in public clinics and public hospitals. And often, if they were non-paying patients, their bodies without the consent of informed consent or any consent of their loved ones would be used for medical experimentation, and also that street children, when they were killed, because there were death squads operating in this area, their bodies would be mutilated. But at that point when I was writing, I assumed that the mutilation was really just to make a point to spread a kind of culture of terror in the community. To make a long story short, after I began publishing these interpretive articles on why people believe rumors such as this, I was invited to serve on an international task force called the Bellagio Task Force on the Global Traffic in Human Organs, made up of about a dozen international transplant specialists, surgeons, transplant coordinators, people involved in the acquisition and distribution of organs. And I was the only anthropologist. There were also a medical sociologist and David Rothman, a medical historian. And I found that the transplant surgeons really liked what I had to say because it suggested that there really was no truth to the rumor of organ stealing, and they really wanted me to write more in this vein of kind of looking at the metaphors of fear and the fact that, well, yes, there are general fears because poor people aren't treated right, but really it has nothing to do with the real practices of organ harvesting. And I began to worry about the way I was being used in terms of providing a certain justification. The more I sat in on the meetings, the more I began to learn that things were not really okay in terms of the world of organs harvesting and distribution. And in this small group, which had people from really Middle East, from Japan, from New York City, from Europe, it became clear that, for example, there were the problems in China of the execution of prisoners and the timing of the execution being set so that organs could be taken immediately, and many of these organs were being used by transplant patients who had traveled from elsewhere and who came to China with cash. And some of the human rights activists were worried that when this very lucrative practice of bringing people to China for transplant began, that the number of executions had increased. So there were worries about that.
You can get executed for quite a number of things in China now.
That's right. That's right. It's sort of like recreating debtor's prison in a sense, or tax evasion and so forth. So there was that problem that we wanted to look at. And then there was the issue of the increasing commodification of organs worldwide, the fact that the AMA was beginning to look at proposals to have a kind of a futures market where the individual could sign away several of their or all of their usable organs, and that maybe a certain amount per organ, if the organs were used, could be given to one's children or whoever one designates. And then there were issues related to just the movement of people from areas of the world where either the criteria for brain death are not accepted, or even if they are accepted now, as in Japan, there's still a lot of reticence. And so there's traveling of people to places where there is an abundance of organs because there's a lot of poor people. And now we're really talking about kidneys, who are willing to sell one kidney. And so you have people from the Gulf States, that was the original scenario, going to India to buy organs. You have the Japanese going to China and elsewhere, Philippines. And when I began to look at this, I said, okay, what we need to know is, from a medical anthropological perspective, who are the buyers, who are the sellers, who are the brokers, who are the intermediaries, how much are people paid? And so that's really how Organs Watch began. And originally with funding for, now it's been 3 years, from the Soros Foundation, but the University of California has also matched some of those funds so that my associate, Professor Lawrence Cohen, and I could set up Organs Watch, and which is a small, independent, anthropological and human rights-oriented research documentation center. And we have been, Lawrence Cohen has been working intensively in India because the sale of organs is widespread and growing in India from south to north. And there are whole regions of India that Lawrence Cohen refers to as the kidney belt. He was recently in Calcutta, I believe it was, and visited a kidney motel. And it was a place where a dozen, mostly young men, but also some women in another part of the hotel, were lying on mats and watching television and waiting for the call, that is, waiting for their match, to match the recipient. And then they would go in and have the operation, receive their $1,000, and they're on their way. So very, very routinized, and he's very interested, Lawrence Cohen, in understanding why now, and why is it increasing and growing. And he has been able to link the increase and growth of sales to debt cycles in India, which he then does link to some of the inequities that this wonderful global economy, which has produced a lot of wealth in a lot of areas, has also produced a lot of people who failed, who've started small businesses and have been wiped out. And he's found that in these kidney belt areas, that it's an implicit, although not written because it would be illegal to write, but it's an implicit understanding from the money lender that if your business fails, we're going to come back and demand a kidney.
Oh my.
So he's looking at that.
I'm speaking with Dr. Nancy Shepper Hughes. She's professor of medicine, science, and the body at University of California, Berkeley, in the anthropology department there. And she's the director of Organs Watch with Dr. Cohen there. And you connect that issue that you just raised of economic crisis in the third world and deprivation to the right. growing neoliberal trends in the world economy. That is, that the growing market orientation and right. logic of contractual capitalist relations
right.
that you think is now invading or commodifying the body as well.
Yeah, I mean, the body has always been commodified, but there is a quantum leap to the big difference between selling hair, for example, selling blood, and selling an irreplaceable body part like a kidney. And that, of course, has been the big gross market. Some people refer to it as a niche market now.
The difference in American law is that we allow people to sell renewable resources like sperm and blood
right.
and quasi-renewable right. ones like eggs.
Right.
But we don't allow them to sell things that they can't renew, like a kidney.
And I think for a variety of reasons. One is that there's a reluctance to put medicine into the position of doing such harm to one class of patients in order to do good for another class of patients, especially when, would you sell a kidney for $2,000 to $10,000? Medical students are quite willing to, and have been, to be involved in risky medical experimentation and, you know, sperm donations and so forth, but there isn't a medical student in the United States that I have encountered and know about, and we have been also canvassing different medical schools about this, who are willing to sell a kidney. So invariably, the kidney sellers are very poor people. The other link is that often what I found coming back from the Middle East, and I'd like to bring this discussion a little bit to a new form of commerce that's emerged in Israel because it links Israel to the United States, is that that in a place like Israel, you have a very sophisticated population, you do have an excellent medical care system, you have very high expectations, and yet very low donation rates. So in the last 5 or 6 years, there's been quite a bit of medical tourism leaving from Tel Aviv with a transplant surgeon who works with doctors, and originally was working in doctors in Turkey and Estonia and Russia and Moldavia and Bulgaria and Romania, where the doctor in those countries would find an individual to sell, and they would do usually 5 or 6 people at a time, bring a private plane to the country, do this in about 4 or 5 days. So the operation takes place in the foreign country with patients being transplanted there, but all their follow-up would be back in Israel. Now, what's interesting is that in almost all of these places, the kidney sellers have themselves been guest workers. They're often people who are stranded, who are, for example, it might be an Indian worker in Turkey, not necessarily a poor Turkish citizen. Or it might be a Bulgarian who is working somewhere else in Eastern Europe. So this is where the sort of neoliberal globalization comes in, mm-hmm. because it involves this fluidity of poor workers as well as fluidity of capital, and on the other hand, an increasing ability of middle-class people to jump on planes and say, yeah, why should we sit here and rot and die, or, you know, be chained up to dialysis when there are plenty of poor people around who are desperate enough to sell a kidney.
Now, the principal ethical debate here, at least in the West, and the principal libertarian challenge to this whole paradigm is that they make a big distinction between the first set of things that you got interested
right.
in, which was theft, lack of good informed consent, lack
yes.
of adequate yeah. compensation,
right. Right.
poor quality.
Right.
All of those issues, yes, they agree.
Yeah.
You should have good quality, good contracts, mm-hmm. informed consent. But
yeah.
they say if someone is in a situation
right.
in life where they make a rational judgment for themselves that the potential future disability of only having one kidney is worth feeding their family for 10 years or
mm-hmm.
have or paying off a significant loan, not having to sell a daughter into prostitution, whatever the calculation is.
Right.
That's something that no one should have a right to interfere. That we own our own bodies,
mm-hmm.
and that and you know that you should have their right. Well, what's the problem with that argument?
I multiple problems. That is, this argument has been supported not only by libertarian groups, but in an editorial by a quite well-known British moral philosopher, Janet Radcliffe Richards, in The Lancet, probably the world's most prestigious medical journal, in an article called The Right to Sell a Kidney. And she basically understands this in contractual relations, that is, a potentially win-win situation. I'm desperate. I might die without a kidney. You're desperate because you can't feed your family. So let's match up and we'll both win. I think the problem has to do with, first of all, is there really informed consent? I think in how much coercion is involved. For example, women in India tend to be the greater population, although there are men, you know, who sell, but women are often first asked, and they're often pressured by family members to sell a kidney. So there's the problem of what pressure underlies this when you have desperation. And secondly, the social and economic context that makes the choice to sell a kidney in an urban slum of Calcutta or in a Brazilian favela, you know, can't be construed as anything, you know, but a free and autonomous choice.
So
because
people,
you could say the executioner is looking over the back.
Yeah, if people are too desperate, they can't make a fair contract.
Well, they can't, and also they're not told basically what the risks are of donating a kidney. The doctors...
But that's fixable. You could theoretically have a regulatory solution that would require good informed consent, good oversight.
Yeah, there are interesting proposals. I mean, one is to suggest that you would have organs banks like blood banks. This is what the Israeli government is beginning to think about, so that individuals who want to sell don't have to be exploited by intermediaries. They would go to this bank and they would have a kidney taken, and then the government or whatever regulatory agency that's set up would decide, you know, on the basis of fairness and social justice rather than the highest bidder, you know, would get that kidney.
Well, let's talk about that for just a second, because the other principal alternative and the other policy that's pursued in many European countries is presumed consent.
Right, right.
And occasionally in countries around the world, outright nationalization of organs.
Right.
Just the assumption that all organs, as it used to be under feudal systems, all
right.
organs belong to the government and or belong that you, the people are presumed to have a collectivist ethos.
That's right.
And you said that in our opening to this that that could actually work with financial incentives as well, that people could be given some kind of reimbursement for having allowed
right.
their organs, not having a card in their pocket that said, "Don't take my organs."
Right.
That's the presumed consent argument, that the government should take all organs except when someone has a card in their pocket that says, "Don't take my organs."
That's right. That's the way it's called, an opting out system. That is that everyone is presumed we're in this together. There's a collective social body. You may need it for your family. You know, you can't, so it's a way of protecting everyone. The problem is that whereas that works quite well in some, but certainly not all European countries, there's some countries that, Germany, for example, is very anxious about, having presumed consent.
They're anxious about anything having to do with the body.
That's right, that's right. And but in general, in a place where you have a minimum, really, compared to the rest of the world, of social inequities, and where you have concern about, you know, gender differences, and where you have had a system of very good nationalized health care, people do feel a loyalty then to the system and to medicine, and they feel that that what goes around comes around. This is a fair system, and so it can work well there. You try to impose a presumed consent on a place like Brazil, which happened about 4 years ago, and, you know, you have massive protests because
rich people are going to opt out, and poor people are going to get their organs.
Yeah, and poor people will be presumed on as they always are, and there'll be race differences. And, in fact, what we have seen is looking at, in general, the flow and distribution of organs, it's no surprise that, in general, you have to be fairly healthy and fairly well off and fairly well insured to get transplanted. Otherwise, the doctors and the, you know, the medicine is not really that interested in you, and you have to sort of be referred on by lower levels of medicine until you finally get up to the top to say, okay, this is a candidate. But what we found is the candidate is often someone who's, you know, in a good financial position. So we've seen that the flow of organs and body parts tends to go from poor to rich and from black and brown bodies to whiter bodies, and from female to male bodies. So there is this sort of, unless that can be fixed, I mean, in the United States, for example, and this is a very controversial thing for me to raise, it is much harder if you're a Latina, especially a Latina woman, or if you're African American, to be considered a good candidate for transplant. And there'll be many, many medical reasons that, you know, would suggest, of course, the, our African-American population. They're not as healthy. They've had more operations. They've had more pregnancies that's put up. And also, they don't donate organs as much. And so this is a question of having enough match. But I really worry about this issue. First of all, the issue about having to have a kind of cross-racial match when, in fact, we are a mixed population. And when, in fact, if you look at South Africa's wonderful transplant program, which was thriving during apartheid, I checked the records. Primarily, it was black and colored, you know, mixed race organs going to whites. There was never a question about match. First of all, we have very powerful drugs, so that the whole question of matching is really, I mean, I don't want to minimize it, but it's not what it was, you know, 15 years ago.
Let me just stick with this issue of context, because the moral dynamic, as you've articulated, has a lot to do with the desperation of life in the third world.
Right.
And so
desperation of life in parts of the first world, right?
Well, that's true, too. But for instance, there is a policy under consideration in Pennsylvania to provide funerary benefits for families who
donate.
You know, we have this ironic situation in the United States where most people are willing to donate their organs. Many people have cards that say donate my organs, but we still leave it up to the family to decide.
Right.
It's like a will that turns out to be optional if the family members don't like it.
That's right.
And so Pennsylvania is trying to overcome that resistance that a lot of families have to cut up their dead relatives by providing funerary benefits. You don't have the problem with desperate people needing to scrabble together money to bury their relatives in Pennsylvania. Right? Isn't that a...
I would think that that would not be a large inducement, but actually it's a system that has operated quite well in some parts of the world that I've traveled to. In Sao Paulo, for example, for years they have given families who have agreed to the donation of their loved ones, they have provided funeral services. And I said, gee, has there ever been any hue and cry about this in Sao Paulo? Have the intellectuals, the medical sociologists, whatever, been upset about this or feel that it's somehow, you know, making an offer that poor people can't turn down? I said, no, because we've long had a system of pauper burials anyway, and this isn't much better than that. We give the basic, they said, we give the basic funeral, you know. The woman was explaining to me, well, if you want candles and, you know, fancy coffins, whatever, that's extra. We're going to give you the basic. And she said it really relieves a lot of people because it's not then viewed as the state burying the pauperized dead, but rather it's your contribution for having contributed to the health of the social body. And so it's done quite well there. So I don't think that that kind of a procedure is terribly morally problematic. Although I can't see how it would work in Pennsylvania.
Right. Now, the other interesting argument, I think, here is that you have drawn a link in your work between the criminal markets in organs and criminal practices and the growth of organ transplantation and financial incentives and commercialization of organ transplantation in general.
Yeah.
A strict libertarian would draw precisely the opposite lesson, that the degree to which explicit commercial incentives and a free futures market in organs is not permitted is the degree to which it will become a criminal market, and you'll have the spread of criminal practices. Now, of course, there's still theft in a situation where capitalist exchange is available, but you would minimize, as in India, you have written that when India tried to criminalize the practices of explicit organ selling, you had the growth of the black market.
Well, you always had a kind of a black market in India because until they passed some explicit laws against it, you could say, okay, it was technically all right, but there were also, you know, long-standing tissues acts that tried to prevent commercialization, although it didn't specifically say you couldn't, as a living person, sell an organ. In India, once they did pass the law, what happened is that what was really became corrupt was the authorization committee that was set up to determine whether the individuals that wish to donate, because they prohibit it, but they said, okay, we can have unrelated living kidney donation, but it has to be altruistic, which is kind of a contradiction in terms.
Right. It's like the bans on surrogate motherhood that say that you can do it for somebody for free, but you can't get paid.
And in fact, Israel has a program that's very similar, and they're trying to prevent this growth of the trafficking and the medical tourism. They've allowed unrelated living donation. They have an authorization committee. It's run by the Ministry of Health. And I met the doctor who is the head of the committee, and he said, well, you know, we approved about 48 of the requests. And he said, of these, I think one, maybe two, was truly altruistic. But, you know, it was not for us. They, you know, to deter, we didn't have enough evidence to say or to interrupt it, and demand is so great, we just signed off on these. Maybe I'm not answering your question, which is to say that I think there'll be a black market either way, to be honest, because it's an extremely lucrative, it can be extremely lucrative, especially if you're dealing with extremely poor people for whom a few thousand dollars seems like a fortune compared to anything else they can sell.
We have a couple more minutes, but it may be that technology is riding to the rescue, that advances in stem cell technology, and I know that this isn't your area of expertise,
yeah,
but whatever thoughts you have, cloning, xenotransplantation, whatever, may make the issue of the transplantation of relatively unmatched organs that need all this immunosuppression moot, because if you have that kind of dough, you might as well just clone your own stem cells.
Right. No, I think absolutely. This is what every transplant surgeon whom I've spoken to has have all their faith that in the next 10 or 20 years, the use of cadaveric organs and certainly having to injure living people to help sick people will be a thing of the past. In fact, one transplant surgeon, Abdullah Dar, from one of the Gulf states, Oman, said that, you know, he really thinks of this stage, you know, the 70s to early 21st century as being a kind of a barbaric stage in the development of transplant surgery. The idea
the cannibalism
of using,
stage.
Yes, a kind of cannibalistic stage, cannibalizing the dead, cannibalizing the living, and something that was necessary, you know, for a phase, but he says he thinks that, you know, in the next century we'll look back on this and say, oh, God, how could they have done that?
I want to recommend that everyone go to sunsite.berkeley.edu/biotech/organswatch, or just look up Organs Watch on the web, and you will get to the Organs Watch website, and there's a wonderful set of documents and links and information about this topic. You also have a republishing of your book about schizophrenia in Ireland coming out?
Oh, yeah. It's just been released, St. Scholars and Schizophrenics, Mental Illness in Rural Ireland, and it's a restudy. It's the original study of the high rates of schizophrenia among rural, especially bachelor farmers. And in 1999, I went back to the small community in West Kerry to see how people were doing 20 years later, and found that that the symptom of choice had shifted from schizophrenia to extremely high rates of suicide among that same population of young, mainly young adult males, although some women as well. So if anyone is interested in looking at the question of schizophrenia in Ireland as linked, the way I also link my work in organs to the political economy, to shifting patterns of land tenure and farming. For me, everything always does go back to that material base. How do people live? How do they make a living? What do they need to do in order to survive?
I understand where that comes from, and we'll just leave that the unspoken man at the table. And if people want to email you and talk about your work, it's nsh@ssl.berkeley.edu.
SSCL.berkeley.edu. That's it.
And I really want to thank you. I've been speaking with Dr. Nancy Shepherd Hughes. She's a professor of anthropology at UCal Berkeley and the director of Organs Watch. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, James. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio.
Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS-FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's J-H-U-G-H-E-S at changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com. Previous Change Surfer radio programs can be listened to from www.changesurfer.com and streaming MP3, thanks to the Radio for All project.